Carolina strong leader and get their attention. The court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-7002L. Abute Kasai Kabai of the United States versus Russian Federation L. Dose 110. Mr. Broderick for the appellant, Mr. Lewin for the athlete.
Mr. Broderick. Before you begin, and Madam Clerk, if you would hold the clock a minute, let me just make an announcement that I hope is not necessary to make, but in view of what happened here in court on Friday, everyone has been told repeatedly not to use electronic equipment, not to check BlackBerries, not to use cell phones, and so forth. This is a long morning. We've got three big cases. If you absolutely feel that you have to use an electronic device, leave the courtroom, because on Friday, somebody's use of an electronic device blew our speaker system. We had to take a recess, and it's very, very disruptive. So not only will you be removed if you are using it, but we may not stop there. So with that warning, Mr. Broderick, go ahead.
I will adhere to the court's advantage. Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I will be presenting the argument for the Russian Federation, the Russian Ministry of Culture and Mass Communication, the Russian State Library, and the Russian State Military Archives. They are appellants in the archive appeal and appellees in the library appeal. I have reserved, with the court's permission, 2 minutes for rebuttal time, if the court will accept that. This case presents the issue of whether property that is located in the territory of a foreign sovereign, claims for possession of that property are within the jurisdiction of the United States District Court, the United States Courts. This is property that has never been in the United States. As this court explained in Peterson, the expropriation exception to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act turns on the first question of whether or not rights in property that were taken in violation of international law are at issue. The court's decision in Peterson, finding no such rights in the case before it, turned not, as Chabad would have it, on the intangible nature of the property in question, but we submit on the contingent nature of the alleged rights in question. And that seems to us the difference. The district court got it right with respect to the library that when the library was taken in the 1920s, when it was expropriated and nationalized by the communist government of the then Soviet Union, it was the property of the fifth or the sixth rebbes. It was the personal property of those rebbes.
I don't really understand that claim at all. You appear to rely heavily on the Gharari case. I cannot see how the Gharari case can possibly have any collateral estoppel effect here. Chabad won completely against its adversaries there, and the question that you raised, the difference between the Rebbe's ownership and the Chabad's ownership as trustee and the exact origins of its title were not a basis on which Chabad could have appealed or cross-appealed.
It seems to me, Your Honor,
that was a dispute, if there was a dispute, between Chabad and the Rebbe's heirs.
Correct, Your Honor. As Judge Posner said,
I'm sorry, I misstated that. The case was between Chabad and the Rebbe's heirs. The dispute you're talking about is a potential dispute, as far as I can make out, completely potential, between Chabad and the religious community for which it is representative.
Well, Your Honor, it seems to me that the proposition that Chabad could had rights since forever in the Rebbe's personal books and property was necessarily rejected by the court in Gharari. That issue was before the court.
The court took a particular route to its conclusion in favor of Chabad, right?
Correct.
But it appellate practice 101 that you can't appeal the route taken by a district court.
Why does it matter? I mean, isn't your focus rights and property? You don't have to be on the collateral estoppel stage to make the argument.
No, Your Honor. In fact,
I mean, isn't that your answer, Judge? I mean, I thought you were presenting the case. I mean, I understood you to be presenting a case which says, in effect, we have that as well. But if the Second Circuit never entered the fray, they still have not satisfied the rights and property prong of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act upon which they are attempting to appear in court.
That is correct, Your Honor. And
and what is the basis, then, of that argument?
The basis of that
argument, particularly in light of your concession at the outset that it was not necessary for them to prove ownership.
Well, Your Honor, it's not my concession in the sense that it is an element of this court's subject matter jurisdiction. And
what is the it in that sentence?
The it is that rights and property taken in the rights taken in violation of international law be placed at issue by the claim.
Okay, there are two issues, I take it, at least. One is, are the interests rights and property, right?
Correct.
And the other issue is, whose rights are they? Now, Peterson did not seem to speak to the second at all, right?
No, because it was foreclosed by the first.
Well, you say it was foreclosed by the first, but is there any indication in the opinion that the court was about to get to that?
The court describes the fact that there were concessions made at oral argument that the rights that the plaintiff was claiming in the insurance fund were rights that were subject to the will of the sovereign, that is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and could be taken away at any time and were entirely contingent rights, and stressed that those concessions undermined any claim of rights in property, of enforceable rights in property, would seem to be.
Okay. So I'm not sure how that advances your case at all.
It advances our case here, Your Honor, because we think that Ghawari clearly stands for the proposition that before.
But now you're back to collateral estoppel, I take it.
Not just collateral estoppel. In some sense, it seems to me, it's almost direct estoppel. That is, estoppel by pleading. In their complaint, they allege that the rights that they have in the collection are those rights that are described in the Ghawari case. And those rights that are described in the Ghawari case are not the rights that they are claiming before this court, because the Ghawari case does not hold that that their rights are from time immemorial, if you will, in the Rebbe's books and possessions. And that, it seems to me, is why one needs to look, at least to some degree, to the Ghawari case to decide this question. And as Judge Edwards points out, they have the burden, it seems to me, of establishing rights and property.
Well, as my understanding, I mean, the principal battleground here is the district court's determination as a matter of law that under the statute, the expropriation exception does not require rights and property actually belong to the plaintiff. Now, at first, second, and third blush, that seemed extraordinary to me as a proposition, because it goes so far as to implicate notions of standing. I don't know how you can read the statute that way. Now, you can elaborate, and I'm going to ask the other side as well. I don't know how you can come into court and say under the statute there are rights and property somewhere. There is property and someone has rights in them. We don't have to show that we have the rights and we're in under the statute. That's the way I read the district court opinion. It doesn't require that they actually belong to the plaintiff, which means if I had an interest, I could sue too.
I agree, Your Honor, and it seems to me that in a sense, again, given that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act creates no substantive rights, that this is, in a way, a statutory standing test. That is, that you must be able to show rights in property that were taken in
not
violation of
just that there is property with respect to which someone has rights.
Exactly.
Just to go back. Let's assume that for purposes of showing the exception, the plaintiff must establish rights and property. Assume that as a matter of law. Now, so far as this appeal is concerned, it's very hard for me to see how you could win on that proposition. You could get a remand on that proposition, but I don't see how you could win on it given your position in your motion to dismiss. Or you're saying the district court is wrong here in saying the defendants conceded for jurisdictional purposes only Habat's claims of right to the entire collection?
Your Honor, the issue of subject matter jurisdiction, it seems to me, is open to challenge at any point in litigation.
Yes, but we can't assume facts in your favor that you conceded at the district court.
It seems to me that's a procedural question as to whether or not rights taken in violation of international law have been properly placed at issue by the claims in this case. As we said, the case as it was postured in the Central District of California did not have the benefit of this court's explanation of the hierarchy, if you will, of the expropriation exception to the foreign sovereign immunities.
So it would seem to me then,
and
the remedy, if there's a problem, the remedy would be to remand for the district court to address the issue of Habat's property interest.
Your Honor, this is a question of sovereign immunity and subject matter jurisdiction, and where it seems to me that, as the district court in Garari said, that the claim that Habat had rights in the property before it was delivered in trust to New York was based upon, and I believe the words were, implausible arguments, and where it was soundly rejected. And I understand the court does not like me going back to Garari.
It sounds like an effort to try collateral estoppel again, which you've lost me on.
If I may go back to that issue, Your Honor, as Judge Posner said in the Warner Electric case, one may appeal if one has something to gain. And in this case,
to gain from the litigation.
From the litigation, exactly.
And what did Habat have more to gain from the litigation than what it gained?
A finding that it had always owned the property, not that
finding,
it was.
You talk as if the Southern District of New York was sort of an Olympian determinator of rights in the world. It was the Southern District of New York was involved in litigation, was handling litigation between two parties.
Agreed, Your Honor, but Habat put before the court in that case the proposition that it had always owned the property. It also put before
that, that was the route that the court took, but it gave Habat victory.
It did, Your Honor, but it gave Habat a victory that was less than what it wanted, and that was because
only vis-a-vis people who were not before the court.
Well, they were in the sense
vis-a-vis the parties it was litigating with, it was a complete victory.
They were before the court, Your Honor, it seems to me, in the sense that Habat was declared to be the trustee for the entire Habat community. That included the litigants, the Gararis in that case. And Habat, by virtue of that case, was put in a legal position where it had the duties of a trustee in charitable trust and owed duties that were enforceable by third parties as a matter of law by virtue of the court's findings.
What brought those duties into play in that case?
The finding.
The rabbis heirs were claiming complete ownership, right?
Correct. And the rabbis
lost completely.
Yes, and they are now, they have the status by virtue of that case as beneficiaries of a charitable trust. And it seems to me that is not what Habat wished to have. And it seems to me it is also something that could have been cross-appealed. Habat was unmistakably putting forth the position that it was the owner outright of those, and it did not win that proposition. I see that my time is winding down.
Do you read what you wrote the same way that Judge Williams reads it, that is a concession on the rights of property use. In the motion to dismiss, you said, here for purposes of this motion only, the first prong, rights and property at issue, is not disputed inasmuch as plaintiff's claims of right to the library and the archive are placed in issue by the plaintiff's complaint. I don't even know what that means, but what is it you think you've argued with respect to that point?
There is a footnote that accompanies
the footnote.
Okay, that says that we are contesting the rights and property and maintaining that is an element that they have to show, and we made that plain when the case came to the District of Columbia that is what we were contending. We briefed it in the court below. It was fully argued in the court below, and Judge Lamberth reached that issue, but we think. And he reached it, he implicitly reached it with respect to the library, and we think he should have reached it with respect to the archive and come to the same conclusion. I see that my time is winding down, and I want to make a brief a point on the act of state doctrine, and that is that each of the acts of state that Chabad is challenging, the actions of the Bolshevik government, the actions of the USSR and the actions of the Russian Federation, are quintessential acts of state: expropriation of property, the acts of a judicial body, the acts of a legislature. They are acts taken within the territory of the Russian Federation, and as
true,
such,
the library, not for the archives. I mean, you make a strong opening in the blue brief on the location of the archives when taken, but then. By the time we get to the yellow brief, you seem to say, well, there are a lot of issues here.
I agree, Your Honor. Our position on the archive is that the exhaustion of remedies doctrine, which we believe is imported into the
foreign.
All right. We'll give you some time in reply.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, maybe it would be most effective for me first to address Judge Edwards' question regarding rights and property. Our position is not that we don't have to prove the right in property. We acknowledge we will have to, at a trial, prove that Agudas Hasidei Chabad owns the library and the archive. The point at this juncture, however, is this is at the very threshold of the litigation. And what Judge Lamberth held was that for purposes of a motion to dismiss the issue of who owns the library, whether it was owned by the individual Rebbe or whether it was owned by Agudas Hasidei Chabad today or even in 1917, is not an issue that can be determined on a 12B1 motion.
Well, actually, I'm not sure that's right. I mean, that's why I'm asking the question. When we're talking about subject matter jurisdiction, these matters routinely can be converted into what is a mini trial on the requirements of subject matter jurisdiction, and even converted into summary judgment if necessary. But affidavits can be presented to dispose of the issue short of a full trial on the merits of the case.
That's definitely true, Judge Edwards. And had Russia not conceded, here's where the language of the concession becomes very important, had they not stated as what they did, then it's possible that Judge Lamberth would have said to the parties, okay, now let's see whether Agudas Hasidei Chabad owns this. We'll have a mini trial, exactly as you said. He said,
Where do you think it's conceded? Because Judge Lamberth didn't say it was conceded.
Oh, he did say it was conceded, but he went on to rule on it in any event. But I think the language, he begins by saying there was a concession, and then he goes on to say, I'll rule on it as well, in any event. But the point is, procedurally, had they not made the concession, then, before Judge Lamberth, it would have been perfectly proper. But Judge Lamberth said, no, we're not taking new evidence. He wanted only memoranda on District of Columbia law, once the case was transferred to the District of Columbia. So if this court were to say, look, it is appropriate at this point to make the rights and property issue and to have the court decide it, then exactly as Judge Williams said, the proper thing to do would be to remand and say, okay, now have your mini trial.
Yeah, because neither a trial judge nor an appellate judge can accept a concession on a subject matter jurisdiction if it appears as a serious issue.
I understand that.
That can't be dispositive.
I understand that. But nonetheless, in view of what they said, the issue before Judge Lamberth was a very narrow one, and there was no evidence taken. We submit that it would be appropriate to remand the case ultimately to the district court, we think, on both archives and library, and I'll get to the library in a minute, but to send the case back. And we think the whole matter of ownership, who owns these properties, the library and the archive, could be decided at a trial, a trial on the merits. There's nothing that would prevent that. If Judge Lamberth had said, look, I won't decide the rights and property issue right preliminarily, but I think we'll have discovery and then a full trial, and we'll decide whether Agudas Casita Chabad owns this or owned it then, that would have been, we submit, an appropriate procedure, but certainly what you're saying, Judge Edwards, would be an appropriate procedure as well. But that was foreclosed by their concession, essentially, and by the procedure in the district court. Now, coming to the merits, this is an extraordinary situation. Assuming, for example, I put to the court a hypothetical, assuming a large Jewish library were seized by the German Nazi government in 1937. And then assuming today's German government were to say, okay, that was really wrong. We're not anti-Semitic, and today's German government isn't. However, this library is part of the cultural heritage of Germany, and therefore, we're entitled to keep it. I think nobody would say that's an act of state, that's not a violation of the expropriation provision. Under the Altman decision in the Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit, which the Supreme Court didn't grant cert on, but nonetheless, the Ninth Circuit said clearly a taking by the Nazi government for the purpose of persecuting Jews and taken from Jews just because they were Jewish is not entitled to active state. It's clearly an expropriation. We submit what the Russian government is saying today is parallel in every way to that hypothetical. The Russians, through the Bolsheviks and the communists in 1917, 1920, and the mid-1920s, persecuted their Jewish population. They sentenced the Rebbe to death.
There's at least one difference, and that is the Bolshevik government was almost universally confiscating any private property. In other words, I don't dispute you that there were likely all kinds of anti-Semitic impulses at work, but they were not necessary to the result in that case, necessary to explain the behavior of the Bolshevik government.
It's true that they did expropriate much, much more than the Nazi government did, but to the extent that they dealt with this library, they did it not because they were taking it for some purported governmental, communistic, socialistic purpose. They were taking it to suppress and persecute Jews in the Soviet Union. And the proof of it is that they sentenced the Rebbe to death. They ended up
they sentenced a lot of people to death.
Pardon?
But
we submit this is something which we should be able to prove at trial. If we fail, you know, whatever the consequences are, the question is whether at this preliminary juncture the plaintiff should be prohibited from proceeding with a trial at which it could establish, and we submit it could establish, that the taking in 1917, 1920, whenever it's viewed as a taking by the Bolsheviks and the communists, was parallel to the taking that the Nazis did of Jewish property in the 1930s. That's our one argument. Of course, our second argument is that even if one views it as a taking, as an ordinary taking, no different than others that the Bolsheviks took, they took it not from a private party who was a citizen of the Soviet Union, the Rebbe, but we think we can prove a trial, and some of that evidence was introduced in the Gurari trial. We could prove at trial that this was property of an international religious organization, even back in 1917 and 1920. It was not private property. What happened in the Garari case, and some of the evidence that's reported in the Garari case, and I did have the honor of representing Agudas Chasidei Chabad both in the trial court and in the Court of Appeals in the Garari case. And let me say in that regard, Judge Williams, that what you said to counsel is absolutely true. We won the Garari case totally. With regard to the litigation.
Counsel argued ultimately that the Rebbe's heirs are in some way, as a result of the Garari decision, beneficiaries of a trust that it would be advantageous, potentially, for Chabad to deny, to have rejected.
The fact is, Judge Sifton took the narrowest ground of a whole range of arguments that we presented to him. There's no doubt about that. He could have said, from the very inception, this library, and let me say again, this was a totally different library. The library in the Garari case was a library which was begun in 1925 after this library had been taken by the Bolsheviks and the communists. So another library was begun, and Judge Sifton said, okay, I'm not going to decide that this library belonged to Agudas Chasidei Chabad from the outset, although the Rebbe, when he was in Poland, wrote saying, please, Agudas Chasidei Chabad, take back the books that you loaned to me. That's what the Rebbe said in his letters. But regardless of that, Judge Sifton said, I'm not accepting your broad ground, I'm accepting a narrow ground. And I don't know how we could possibly have appealed from a case that we won totally, even as to the books that came after the war.
Well, the argument is that in some way, the judgment of the district court gave the rights of a trust beneficiary to the otherwise losing party.
And really gave us all the relief we wanted, which was that the defendant in the case could not go out and make any private claim to these books and sell them. That's what initiated the lawsuit. We brought a lawsuit against him saying these are not private property, they belong to the community, and you can't go out and sell them. We went into court seeking an injunction against him on that basis, and we won that case totally. If I had tried to appeal from footnote 9 of Judge Sifton's opinion, it would have taken the Second Circuit 10 seconds to say, that's moot. You can't possibly appeal from the fact that the judge in footnote 9 said something that you don't like and didn't accept your broadest argument.
Let me go back to your argument on the act of state doctrine as to the library, because I'm really not following it. There was clearly a taking in 1917 and 20, and it was certainly by those in power in Russia, and that those takings were then certified by the acts of state in the 1990s. And I'm not sure what you have left, and what remedy do you think you have? The Russian government in the 1990s, by the various acts taken with the arbitration board, et cetera, has made it clear that this is our decision. So now the United States government court is supposed to issue what to the Russian government and say, notwithstanding your acts of state, we're mandating what?
Remanding the return of a library.
Well, then what is the act of state? I mean, I understand what you want, but what is the act of state doctrine about then? I thought it would precisely cover that kind of a situation.
But it does not cover, and the Sabatino case made it clear, there are situations where it does not cover and does not entitle a sovereign to claim an act of state. And one of them, we submit, is, and that's why I made the parallel with the Nazi taking, that if the German government today said, okay, with an official German act, we are keeping a library that Hitler took in 1937.
Well, you see, but the problem with the archive situation factually is very different. And so when you reference back to that, it's a different fight. It's about rights of property, at least as I'm looking at it, because it was never taken by act of state in the first place. So that's different.
But
here we have a situation where there isn't any doubt whatsoever there were acts of state that certified the taking if the doctrine exists and we are bound to follow it, I'm not sure how we get out from under it. In other words, the horrible hypotheticals don't necessarily relieve us of our obligation to follow the law.
Correct.
The act happens every day.
Yes, Judge Edwards, but the fact is the original taking back in 1917 and 1920 was not protected by the act of state doctrine for two reasons.
Wait, but let's assume that's right. Okay?
Right.
I don't know how you get around, because there's nothing in the doctrine that forecloses, is how you subsequent acts of state that certify the original takings.
Well, two answers to that. One is that the subsequent act of state, and we argue that in the brief in 1992, is itself an expropriation. Even though it is a taking, it comes in under the second Hickenlooper Amendment. It came in 1992.
Okay, let's assume that I think the expropriation occurred in 17 and 20, and you're just it's subsequently certified. So I'll remove that argument.
All right.
The second argument.
Then our point is that the taking in 1917 and 1920 is not protected by the act of state doctrine because it is the kind of taking that is outside of what Sabatino contemplated, because it is discriminatory, not done for a public purpose, and without compensation, and done to suppress the Jewish community. That's something we should be able to prove at trial. We agree. It's our burden to prove that at trial. But if we prove at trial...
Well, wait. Now, let me make sure I'm understanding you. You think the case law suggests that the goodness of the foreign government is in play when we decide to apply the act of state doctrine?
Absolutely.
Really?
That's
what,
exactly what happened in the Altman case, Your Honor. The Altman case, the Austrian government, the Nazi government took paintings, and the court said that is not a permissible act of state. This is the Ninth Circuit. I'm not saying the Supreme Court had said it, because they only dealt with a retroactivity issue. But the Ninth Circuit said, and the ultimate decision in Altman was, and indeed, I think the Supreme Court also kind of assume that taking...
Where do you think the Supreme Court assumed?
Well, all right, I take that back. I'm
okay.
Sorry. The Supreme Court didn't reach that question.
I understand your argument perfectly, but I don't see the case law.
Well, the case law is Altman and any Nazi taking. I don't think this court would say, as I said, if the German government said today, passed a law saying a taking that was done in 1937 of a Jewish library.
I understand your hypo, and I don't think the archive situation is parallel to the library.
Not
situation.
The archives. I'm talking about the library, not the archives. I'm talking about the library in 1917. Why is it any different when the Bolsheviks and the communists take a library because they want to persecute Jews in 1917 and 1920? And then today's Russian government says it's a cultural heritage of the Russian people, so therefore we're entitled to keep it, than it would be if today's German government said that what Hitler took in 1937 is now a cultural heritage of the German people. It's totally parallel. And we submit, we're ready to undertake the burden at trial of establishing that parallelism. But if it's parallel, if it's true that the 1917 and 1920 takings were done to persecute Jews and as part of religious persecution, I don't see the difference between this case and the Altman case.
Just to sort of flesh out where the key distinctions lie, so suppose suit had been brought, of course, Sabatino hadn't been decided, but suppose suit were brought in 1938 to recover the hypothetical German library, Jewish library in Germany, confiscated in 36. So there's no change of regime at the time of the suit. What outcome?
I think this court's duty would be to say that under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, that is not protected by the act of state doctrine. The Sabatino case itself recognizes it doesn't protect every action by a foreign government. And let me say one other point, Judge Edwards.
That passage this morning and the sort of rumination on various factors, and then the wind-up sentence is, therefore, all we decide today is that an act of state challenged against the same government, an act within its own territory, will not be reexamined in
That's the holding. But let me make one more point with regard to Judge Edwards. The other distinction is that we maintain, and it's related to the rights and property, but it's also related to the merits. We maintain that the this property was owned in 1917 and 1920 not by a Russian citizen, not by the Rebbe personally, but by the entire worldwide Chabad community, in which case it is not an active state, because what it does is it affects rights not with regard to their own citizens, but with regard to property that's owned by an international community. And consequently, we submit that would be an expropriation that would not be covered, and we should be able to prove that at trial. Our main point is, and I see my time is up, our main point is this is the threshold of a litigation. The question is Agudas Chasidei Chabad to be foreclosed at this threshold from making the proof, and from, we accept that burden of proof, but from establishing at a trial that these component elements of an expropriation that is not covered by the active state doctrine and that would be give rise to liability under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, whether it should be foreclosed at this juncture. And we submit Judge Lamberth was right with regard to the archives. We think he was wrong with regard to the library, because the library is also subject, for the reasons I've stated and for those that appear in our brief, to the claim under the expropriation exception. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Okay. Why don't you take 3 minutes, Mr. Broderick?
Thank you, Your Honor. On the subject of the active state doctrine, it seems to me the problem for Chabad is that it runs smack into U.S. v. Belmont and U.S. v. Pink, in that the very acts of nationalization, expropriation of property, as Judge Williams said earlier, which went on a wholesale basis in the Bolshevik, under the Bolshevik regime and under the communist regime, were in fact acts of state that could not be inquired into, indeed such that in United States versus Belmont and United States versus Pink, the United States government, as the assignee of rights that the Soviet government had acquired by virtue of expropriation, was entitled to bring claims on those rights in the United States courts. So it seems to me that the acts that were that he's complaining of, that we are focusing on originally, are clearly acts of state. It would involve essentially to put those questions at issue in this case would essentially be, and well, I think ultimately to be reversed to going against Belmont and Pink, and it would be in effect to try and retry the entire sort of history of the communist and Bolshevik revolutions, and as the decrees that were issued pursuant to which the property was expropriated, they were not discriminatory, except that they were discriminatory against private property and not against private property owned by a particular person. Unfortunately,
is that an issue?
It's not an issue. It's an issue on the takings point, and it is not an issue.
Is it a relevant issue with respect to which there has to be a trial?
No, I don't think it is a relevant issue for purposes of application of the active state doctrine.
Because why?
Because the motives of the government in expropriating property are never relevant, because expropriation of property, unlike other acts by governments, has the international takings doctrine has yet to be.
And what authority says that, just like I asked Mr. Loon, what authority says, because this is where I'm confused with both of you, says that it really doesn't matter. There could be a decree, could have been a decree in Russia that says, take this property because we're out to persecute the Jews and get all of it. And we clearly want to expropriate it. And we have that evidence, absolutely clear. Does that change the posture of the case?
Your Honor, I do not believe that it does.
You're not sure?
I'm not sure, but I think I can take comfort in the fact that,
well,
again,
do you have some authority? I mean, I
think the authority is that under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, jurisdiction is limited to the exceptions that are spelled out in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, and it is not, it does not include takings of the sort that the court is.
So motive is never relevant, in your view, under the existing case law?
For purposes of a taking in violation of international law, it is relevant insofar as the question of whether or not an alien is being discriminated against. That is the question that is put by the international takings exception of the expropriation exception. The discrimination is not on the basis of, it's between domestic and alien persons, because the international law,
as long as you have a citizen, in your view, it does not matter what the motive of the foreign government is.
Exactly, Your Honor. For better or for worse, we do not inquire into the motives with which a foreign government treats its own citizens.
But you're saying then it depends on the citizenship of the previous owner? In other words, the act of state slips away, becomes irrelevant if the owner is not a citizen?
No.
Then,
I mean,
then obviously there are factual issues of considerable weight here.
Act of state doctrine, it seems to me, applies where there are acts of the state within its own territory taken as a government, and as this court said in Wrong versus Broadside, the expropriation of property, in that case by the Chinese government, is a quintessential act of state. And again, I think that the issue of
I just thought you used language suggesting that there would be an exception if the act were found to be discriminatory against foreign owners, which is was one of.
Well, I was going back. The act of state doctrine, it seems to me, sort of it does merge to some degree with the merits claim of a taking in violation of international law, in the sense that international law is only concerned with takings from aliens as opposed to takings from domestic citizens. And in that sense, the question of active, whether it's an act of state applies. But Sabatino obviously tells us, which is a taking from a foreign citizen,
right,
that question is subject to, right, act of state doctrine.
Yeah, okay.
With that, Your Honor, I submit.
Thank you.